Hey, Ryan.
Adam.
How you doing, dude?
Good. Do the thing. Do that. That was accurate and cool.
May thy blade chip and shatter.
Why? Why were you Batman?
Well, that's kind of what Fade Rauthus kind of sounds like.
May thy braid chip and shatter.
Why braid? What? May my braid chip and shatter.
May my, yeah, no. I'm sorry, blade.
There you go. No, may he sounds like. Okay.
Chip and shatter.
You're usually on point with.
Well, to be fair, I only heard it from the movie. I have not heard it since, so I'm just going off of pure memory here.
Yeah, that's how impressions work.
May my brain chip and shatter.
No, it's not getting better. Actually, weirdly, it's getting worse.
Oh, if I heard it, I'd be able to mimic it perfectly, though. We all know this.
You heard it days ago.
I did. It was a couple days ago.
Yeah. Anyway, that's fine. Dune Part 2.
Dune Part 2. Enter the Sandverse.
I don't believe that. I don't think that's what it's called. Dune Part 2.
I'm sticking to it.
It is covering the second half of the first Dune book. Written by Frank Herbert oh so long ago, directed by Denis Villeneuve, and
wait, say his name again.
Denis Villeneuve. That's accurate.
Denis Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
Anyway, go on.
And written by him and John Spathis, who, by the way, is writing a new Van Helsing movie.
Oh, sounds interesting.
Neat.
Yeah,
and we got the band back together. You know, Timothy Chalamet is Paul Atreides once more. We have Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin. We have Stellan Skarsgård, and you know, we have also added some friends. We have Javier Bardem, by the way, as well. Added so some good friends. Austin Butler.
Yeah.
By the way, made this movie prior to being Elvis, so he didn't have his chance yet to be Elvis.
Crazy.
I know. It took that long.
Oh my god, I didn't know that.
We have Dave Bautista, Leah Seydoux, Christopher Walken, and then Florence Pugh. And for one moment, Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah, that was wild.
Must have had her call sheet must have been like, you're gonna be here for 5 minutes.
Oh yeah, I mean, she's too busy filming Furiosa,
right?
Well, which now she's filming Furiosa.
I assume that's already done as well.
Oh yeah, you're right.
The trailer for that is before Dune Part 2.
That's true.
Aptly named Dune Part 2 Electric Boogaloo, I believe.
Yeah, but and it actually rhymes.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, Paul Atreides unites with Shani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. And that is the Harkonnens as proxies, sort of, for the Emperor, played by Christopher Walken. And we get to meet him and see the dealings of the Emperor. We also get to meet his daughter, played by Florence Pugh. So that is also added. The political intrigue of the Duneverse is also added on top of what has already been built in the first movie. And let's say this right up top. So I want to kind of break this down into sections, which is first section, just a gush about the movie with no spoilers to the book and the movie. Second, after that, a kind of run through of the plot of the movie Dune Part 2, full of spoilers, and then a look forward to Dune Part 3 as that is going to be, although it is down the road, it's said to not be filming for at least a few years.
Yeesh.
Which makes sense because it's covering the second book in the series, Dune Messiah, and that is supposed to be in the books like 10 years down the line. So that timing makes sense, but also this is kind of, I don't know how many franchises are being made right now that are cooler than Dune.
Right.
My sense is not many.
Yeah, so yes, coming up blank.
While disappointing, I suppose it follows the sort of laid out narrative slightly that the books have. So I'm cool with that, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
So what'd you think of the movie?
Oh, let me tell you, it was beautiful. It was so beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, the first one was also very beautiful, but this stepped in a new realm of how to capture the essence of this desert planet. It really is gorgeous. They had a lot of very cool sunset or sunrise scenes, depending on what there was a lot of time jumps here. I think there was a lot of time jumps. There was a point in the middle there where I felt a little discombobulated with like when this stuff is happening, but I kind of got reeled back in with some of the events that happened later on. But the movie was beautifully filmed, and the actors are absolutely killing it, no pun intended. Austin Butler was really good as Fade Rautha. I thought he was excellent. I thought his whole crazy power struggle, loves, pain, and destruction really was believable. And I don't know if you got that out of it, but I sure did.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. The thing that Dune is doing better than any movie franchise and otherwise that is happening right now, better than anyone, is world building. They like the time in which, I suppose this is a slight spoiler, but not really, the time in which we spent on the Harkonnen homeworld, it tells you so much about those people without over explaining it.
Right.
I'm currently watching the live action Avatar The Last Airbender on Netflix, which I'm sure we will cover in the future. And while it is better than many of the live action Avatar The Last Airbenders that have ever happened, which is zero, by the way. This is actually the first one ever.
I was going to say.
No, that's a JK. One has happened. M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong made one, but there is no. Don't worry about it. It's inside Avatar joke. It has no place here. But
understood.
To be fair. But in like the first 10 minutes of it, it did have a huge downfall for me, which is it did that thing where the characters say what they feel out loud and not to camera, like just exposition dumping.
Yeah.
And it gets better over time, which we'll cover more when we talk about that series. But what this movie does amazing job of doing is almost never doing that.
It's
showing us instead of telling us the entire time. And for a movie that is 2 hours and 50 minutes long, it does not feel that way, or at least it didn't to me.
It went by real fast.
I wanted it to keep going.
Yeah, it was that ending sequence there, the last scene with the ships flying. Whew, I was like, man, I don't want this. I don't want to leave. Just run it again.
By the way, it's doing incredibly well. Over the weekend.
I believe it.
It made back its budget.
Oh, I 100% believe that.
The opening day, it reached, if not a little bit more, than the amount that Oppenheimer made. So that will be a good gauge as to how much money Dune Part 2 makes. And many are predicting that it has even longer legs than Oppenheimer does.
Sure.
So it's going to make a crap load of money.
Do you have the figures in front of you? What did it make for the weekend?
$189.6 million, and the budget was $190 million.
That's crazy. It was only that much.
Only?
Yeah, it's just like, you know, when you think of movies, like, some of the biggest movies are $200, $400 million. I mean, Avatar, the original Avatar, was $500 million.
In the first 2 days?
No, was the budget. You said it made more than its budget.
Yes.
That's crazy that it only had that much of a budget. I figured it would be way more.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of CGI in this movie.
Yeah.
Although I would argue it does it in an incredibly tasteful fashion.
For sure, yeah.
It almost never feels like it's being overdone. I bet the amount of CGI is even more than we think it is. Mm. And I don't know how much was happening on large sound stages with LED screens versus how much are they just in the desert. But
right.
Of course, I think it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, because it's an audio medium.
Mm.
Absolutely beautiful movie.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Amazing acting. The soundtrack was great. I weirdly don't think it lived up completely to Dune Part One, but that is also, I think, a byproduct of the fact that there's a lot more silence in Dune Part Two, and it did allow for those moments to happen, because I mean, if we're being honest with ourselves, a lot of Dune Part Two is just trying to articulate the internal struggle of Paul Atreides as he gleans more and more of the future. So those moments, I don't think, really needed an incredibly strong undertone of score. So they let it happen, which is cool. Anyway, I liked the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, this, you talk about the soundtrack in regards to music, but this, and I said this to you as we left the theater, this is probably one of the best sound mixes in a movie I've heard in a long time. The loud parts were loud and thunderous and chest thumping, but they weren't like ear piercing or uncomfortable. And it was never too quiet where you couldn't hear anything. It was a beautifully done mix. I would be really upset if they don't win best sound design for this movie with all of the ornicopters, is that what they're called?
That's pretty close.
Ornithopters, or whatever. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So those things, like the sound they make is incredibly unique, and just the sound of the music and the sound of the worms and the everything that just is happening that brings this world to life is so well done. And I'm so happy we got to see it in theaters, and I'm like very tempted to see it in IMAX if I can, just because it is a step up in that type of experience, and it was so well done.
Yeah, this movie did something better than I think any movie ever made, and that is the sound mixing on the low end.
Oh,
the bass.
My God. Oh, it hit me in the chest so many times.
Yeah, because there are a few movies, like I think Dunkirk is the best comparison for doing bass in a movie well, although that movie did stray a lot into the treble. Like, it was doing a lot of high-pitched stuff a lot of the time that was just like jump scary. Dune felt subtle but big at the same time.
Yeah, it was just super well-rounded. Just everything you heard was incredibly intentional, as it is with a movie. You know, it's an art form, it's intentional, but it felt so cohesive, and I just really appreciate that a lot. And then, you know, that paired with the beautiful, you know, scenes we saw, like, you know, the fight scene between Fade Rautha Paul Atreides. It's in the trailer.
No.
In Paul Atreides. It's right, in the trailer.
Fine. Whatever, dude.
The backlighting silhouette you see. I mean, it on the big screen, it was really good. And yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I was never like a big, I didn't really know much about Dune. You know, our buddy Mark is a huge Dune fan.
Dunehead, you could say.
He's a Dunehead. And I was always intrigued by it, but I never like sourced it. I never like went to learn more about it. And I kind of wish I did, because I've been seeing clips online of the 1980s version of this movie. And there's a lot of comparisons where they took stylistic choices from the original movie and just improved upon them in this movie. And it kind of makes me want to go back and see the original one.
A Dune dude, if you will. Hey,
Dune dude.
I'm not really a reader, per se.
Same, same.
I have no patience whatsoever. That is a fault of my own. although I was on vacation last week and I did start reading a book that I was like actually interested in. It's about mutated spiders running a planet. It's pretty sick.
What's but it like, called, Ryan?
The Chronicles of Time.
Is that the real title, or did you just make that?
It's the real title. Oh, okay. It's a bad title for a pretty good book.
Yeah.
But what I will say is that I read the first Dune ages and ages ago.
Did you?
Yeah. I mean, it came out in like 1965. It is, and this is, I'm sure the world can correct me if I'm wrong, but like one of, if not the best selling epic science fiction books / set of books of all time. So you know, whatever, let's get into let's talk about Dune Part Two and the parts of it that happened.
Now are we gonna throw a spoiler alert to the listeners here, or
that's what I just did, I feel like.
Oh yeah, yeah, spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoilers are now.
Yeah,
so as we come into Dune Part Two, we have a voiceover that is Florence Pugh, and she is the Emperor's daughter, and she is journaling that Paul Atreides may still be alive, while her father, the Emperor, is trying to figure out what to do with all this. He needs to, Christopher Walken, that is, figure out a way where no one finds out that he just genocided the Atreides because he was afraid of them.
I have one comment about
okay.
about the casting of the Emperor. Did you?
Oh, when, yeah, when, no.
Did you hear in our theaters
what?
When Christopher Walken was talking, there
the
was audible giggle. Not you. There
was
audible giggles throughout the theater.
Yeah, I.
Paul,
I think
he's dead, right?
I was also laughing. It. Out of all the casting, if I could choose one to be a different person, it would be him.
Yeah.
I would take Patrick Stewart. I would take Sir Ian McKellen. I would take Ian McShane.
Sure.
I would take almost any one of those over Christopher Walken, who is just doing Christopher Walken. And I don't know, man.
Yeah, it did. I don't want to say grow on me throughout the movie, but it did become less apparent to me throughout the movie. But yeah, it was just like, I can't get Christopher Walken's voice out of my head when I see him. And he is a good actor. Like, there's nothing wrong with him as an actor, but he is a very typecasted actor. And
I would argue that perhaps is something bad about him as an actor, though. It's 'cause
I don't know. I agree with you. I think they could have there would have been a number of people that I would have chosen. But I kind of like that they chose Christopher Walken for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bold choice for a bold movie.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, Paul Atreides and his mother, Lady Jessica, are still alive. And they are with the Fremen, who still don't trust them, like, at all.
Oh, yeah,
and,
no.
Once his mother and him, Paul Atreides, that is, survives a Harkonnen ambush, they then get taken back to the Fremen stronghold. Lady Jessica is told that the Reverend Mother of the Fremen is dying, and turns out you're the new one. So you are going to have to drink the water of life, which is just straight up cerulean blue poison from the depths of a sandworm. And if men try it, they die. And if women try it who aren't trained in the art of transmuting poison, they die. Anyway, here, drink this.
Yeah, that was okay. So that scene was very intense. And she did an excellent job. Just like,
yeah,
showing how much of a struggle she was having while trying to make that work for her. But yeah, that whole, and this was, I think, part of some of the time jump things that I was just struggling with, obviously during my first watch of it. I'll see it again. But like, it felt like things happened so quickly in the beginning to get her to be the Reverend Mother and for Paul to be in the position he ends up being in. It just, it shotgunned through part of that part for me.
Yeah, I wonder if watching Dune 1 and 2 back to back would make it better, because maybe. It is covering one book. So yeah. It is sort of just a line in the sand in the middle of the book where it stops and then starts once more.
That's true.
And there were a bunch of times where I assumed in the bottom left or right of the screen it was about to say 6 to 8 months
later,
but it never did.
I was waiting for that too.
And that's a lot of trust that Denis put in the audience. But it did only take me out of the movie like the first time they did a time jump.
Sure.
And then I was like, all right, they're going to do this a few times.
Yeah.
And you just sort of have to by yourself catch up. Anyway, yeah, Rebecca Ferguson's probably the best actor in the movie.
Oh, and, she's so good.
She should be up for, if not winning a Best Supporting Actress role for this film. So she lives. And
she does.
BT Dubs, she was pregnant. So,
oh, that was terrifying to hear the old Reverend Mother say, "We made a mistake. She's pregnant." Like that cut was like, what's going to happen?
Also, like all the internal seeing the baby like inhale the goop,
yeah,
and then being like, "Whoa, I'm a future telling baby now." And I talk to my mom psychically. And I'm going to stop there and slow down for one moment.
Sure.
So Denis is only going to be doing Dune Messiah, the third movie, and then he doesn't want to do any more Dune. So there are 7 books in the series. Oof. And we'll see if they choose to continue them after Denis leaves. But I was glad that they leaned in to the fetus psychically talking to her mother.
Okay.
Because I think it was the weirdest part of the movie. And this book series gets really, really weird.
I know, like, I've heard.
It rides the line of,
I am
okay,
intrigued.
Frank. All right, Frank. Frank, are you writing this in the early 70s, Frank? You are, aren't you? Okay. Well, Frank, slow down. No, getting weirder. Wow, the weirdest thing I've ever read. Like it gets that weird. And
I want to know.
I know, but I don't think we ever will. I think it's so weird that even if they kept making movies, they're going to have to make like a separate choice. But at the very least, they did lean into psychic fetus talking.
Yeah, so, I think appropriate.
All the while, Paul is making strides and gaining the respect of both Shani and the Fremen alike. And mainly, what's his gosh dang name?
Stilgar?
Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem. Let's talk about him very quickly.
The fastest meme from the movie I've ever seen.
Which is what?
It's the surprised face of him as Stilgar in the movie, and yep. It's just Moed Adib.
Yes. I loved every second Javier Bardem was on screen.
He's so good too. He's so good.
He's absolutely brilliant. One of the best actors of our day. I think he will end up taking Daniel Day-Lewis is done taking roles. Give him to Javier Bardem. Like that man was Anton Chigurh and this guy, like unreal and way more. Like, you almost get any bit of comedy in Dune 2 comes from Stilgar.
Yeah.
I swear to God, the time in which he said, "Paul, you're the one," and Paul was like, "Nah," and then it hard cut to being like, "He's so humble, dude, that he won't even say he's the one." Actual laughter.
Yeah, as written.
As written. Oh my God. Paul is killing it right now, right?
Oh my gosh. It was so good. It was a nice break in like how serious this movie actually is and how strange and sci-fi it is to something that's like actually relatable a little bit. It's like this guy.
Not only serious in the aspects of it that sci-fi, serious in the aspects of like the political intrigue it ties in with all there's a character or two who can see versions of the future.
Yeah.
So a lot of this movie is based on Paul seeing versions of the future where he becomes the de facto leader of the Fremen, both north and south on Arrakis. And that starts a jihad that kills millions for a long, long time.
Yeah.
His mother knows this as well, and she is taking steps, like concrete logistical steps, to get him there, which are, we need to make the weakest Fremen believe in him and then let that by osmosis spread.
Yeah.
We need to do that on both sides of this planet, and I need to be the one to do it because Paul is rejecting the notion of being a leader because he is seeing the future in which millions and millions starve and die because of choices that he specifically makes, which is weighing on him to an incredibly heavy extent.
Sure. Yeah, and there's, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's some malice there in Lady Jessica. Like that there was one shot where they panned over to like the scared and trembling Fremen in the cave, and she says, because they're afraid of us.
Yeah.
And they like do that they almost do like the Kubrick stare. And
yes.
And I was like, ooh.
I mean, she is straight up saying, let me manipulate the scared and weak ones first.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
crazy.
Messed up. That's
it
messed
is,
up.
But so fucking boss.
And then I know. And then all of that political intrigue and you know, discussing indirect / direct genocides and a universe spanning war, all of that, like also going up against, this movie has sandworms you can ride.
Oh, you know, we got a taste of the sandworms at the end of the first movie. I'm like, I wanted it. Like, I know very little about Dune, but I know that there's sandworms and I wanted to see them. Boy, did we get the sandworms.
Yeah. Let's hold off on that for a moment because I want to talk about the third act kill box. In one full-on conversation.
Sure.
Because I think it deserves it. So in the middle of all this, the Harkonnen still exist. And Stellan Skarsgård is, as always, absolutely killing it as Baron Literally. Vladimir Harkonnen. We also get a lot more of Glasso Robin Harkonnen, played by Dave Bautista, in a role that is like really complicated as he's constantly failing and gigantic, but being alpha'd on a constant basis, kissing shoes and such.
Yeah, that transition of power was really, really tense.
And then as well as Austin Butler as Fayad Ratha Harkonnen, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen's youngest nephew and now heir to House Harkonnen, as long as while taking over for Dave Bautista, he, as Baron Harkonnen says, tames the Fremen as well as Arrakis simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah, he comes in and starts to, I mean, he destroys the temple. I was like, oh no. I think I even said out loud, oh no.
Don't do that. No.
Don't do that. And then he's just like, good old fashioned artillery. I'm like, man, right. You are American.
They destroyed all the gross human water.
Yeah, the human water.
Oof, that was tough.
Yeah. Well, that was their tough. Holy land. They didn't even dare drink that.
Wow, gross. But yeah, there's no water here. Got to do what you got to do, you know?
Yeah. Ryan, a Fremen, you are not.
No, not even close. As far away as humanly possible.
You know, I was thinking about this after we saw it. I was like, you know, there are spaceships in this world. Why don't they just go to the Atreides home planet? Like, just go back. There's a bunch of water there.
Who
Paul could bring those people.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons.
The Fremen. But, you know. Well, Fremen, I mean, just like, you know, space. There's spaceships.
They're not going to leave their home, Adam. This is their home.
But then when he explains to Chani, oh yeah, there, you know, what you see here is the dunes of sand. Like we have that, but it's water. And she's like, whoa.
Sure. Not enough to leave her ancestral home.
Yeah, well, you know.
Oh, okay.
Grass is sometimes greener. In this case, it really is.
Nice. So Jessica travels south to unite with more fundamentalist Fremen while Paul is still fearing the holy war that perhaps is inevitable if he goes south and becomes a messiah. At the same time, he reunites with Gurney Halleck, played by Josh Brolin, who subsequently leads Paul to the House Atreides' hidden atomic stockpile.
Yeah.
Now, epic. This part was one of the only parts, like there were only a few times during this movie where I was sort of taken out of it completely, momentarily. Sure. The first time that Christopher Walken talked and the second time, Josh Brolin was like, yeah, we got nukes. Isn't that chill?
We have 90 nukes.
That's a lot.
Oh, yeah, I suppose you're right. Like, that is very off brand, kind of.
Yeah, no, we've been doing desert warfare with daggers. Also, we have a nuclear arsenal that could blow up the entire planet. Like, I don't know. The power creep in that moment, I think, was hard to deal with. But at the same time, Paul's not trying to blow up the entire planet. He uses a few nukes later in the aforementioned kill box that we'll discuss. Mm. But yeah, I don't know. In that moment, I was sort of like, kind of wish there were no nukes.
Yeah. or not as many.
Yeah, just one. Even one nuke.
But then again, what are they called? Deterrent weapons?
Yeah.
Is that what we call them?
No, it's not. Adam, you know, there are a few bodies of water I don't think this podcast needs to swim into. You know what I mean?
You're right.
Let's leave that be over there. Okay. Okay. We're here about entertainment, you know?
So anyway, yeah, there are nukes.
So all the while, we now also get a glimpse of the Harkonnen homeworld. It is, I don't know, I assume shot in black and white, but it is, it stands to reason that the whole world is just black and white.
Well, it's the black sun, right?
Yeah.
Is that what they said? The black sun? Yeah. I did see a very quick explanation, but I didn't watch the whole thing, but it was explained why this was shot. So there was a reason that Denis shot this specifically in black and white, and I wish I had the answer. I'm realizing now that's annoying, but you know.
That you should have not started the sentence?
Yeah. But no, there is a very specific, like, artistic decision as to why.
Yeah, I get it. I'm not him, but the Harkonnens are basically albinos, or at least they have just like paper white skin, and the world is black and white. So just go for it, man. Just kind of commit. And he did. The coolest part for me was how many Harkonnens there are. You get more of a sense of scale.
There's
in this
so
universe.
Many. That stadium just appeared to be a country wide. Like, it was so many.
It was so many. And the after Austin Butler won, which we'll discuss a little bit here soon, the fireworks being like the ink in Arrival, thanks to Nate. He just basically he took those files and he just sort of copy pasted, but awesome nonetheless. I love them in Arrival and I love them here, so
it was great. It was cool seeing like that really desolate, cold, dark world. Very different than Sand Planet.
Yeah, and very different from the Atreides homeworld as well.
Yeah, Atreides homeworld is pretty much like a Earth with more water.
Yeah, better, cooler water.
Yeah, better water, better Earth, super Earth, Helldivers, super democracy. I'm sorry.
Wow. Sorry. Oh my God, you slipped for a minute there.
I've been really into it.
You've been attacking some bugs and or robots?
Let me tell you. Anyway.
Okay, good. Well, so it also, that scene, I think, is like the perfect example of showing, not telling.
Yeah.
As Feod Ratha is fighting the last vestiges of the Atreides fighting force, but they've all been poisoned or maimed prior as to protect Feod's livelihood while he is getting this for his birthday, the murdering of some Atreides. They are also being pretty cautious with him as he is the heir, and they don't want him to be killed, except for the fact that one of them wasn't poisoned. And Baron Harkonnen was like, "You're welcome."
Yeah, yeah, we know you kind of wanted this.
But he didn't, though. He won nonetheless.
Yeah. Yeah.
But later he literally told his uncle, like, "I should murder you right now, dude."
Yeah, right.
And then Baron Harkonnen was like, "I mean, don't, though. And also, you know, just like tame Arrakis and you can be emperor." And then Feod was like, "Emperor? What are you talking about? And he's like, "Well, there will be a power struggle, and the emperor will like come down, and the world will go, and the universe will go into like a large war. And we have all the money because we've been chilling with all the spice for so long. So like, we'll win, and you'll be emperor. So just like, go and take care of the Fremen threat the Dave Bautista can't figure out, and bing bang boom, you'll be emperor. Okay, get out of my house. I'm gonna go into my goop."
Yeah, so this is interesting because, and they may have talked about it in the first movie, but yeah, the Harkonnen are incredibly wealthy because of the spice. But I know the spice is like the rarest substance in the universe, right? They explain that in the first movie.
Yes.
But what is it actually used for? Do we know that? Did I miss that?
Yes. And I'm glad that you asked. Awesome. Because I bet a few people did as well.
Yeah.
It's, yes. One, supply and demand, it's only on Arrakis, and getting it's really tough because you can only dig it up for so long until a large sandworm eats you.
Yeah.
Or the Fremen attack you and kill you. So it's that. But so what it's mainly used for is interstellar travel. It's that exists.
And that's right.
Let's all remember that this is a world without computers. So there are specific people trained to be human computers, and you can pump that ability up with a crap ton of steroids, aka the spice. Like, the Space Guild has helmets on. They live in spice 24/7.
Wild.
And the way in which they figure out intergalactic travel is just by like being so zooted. They're just so zooted. High. They're like, "Okay, dude. Space. The final frontier.
Let's go straight really fast."
Boom. And then they do it. But they need spice to be able to get there.
I do remember this now. Yes, I do remember that.
Anyway, Paul drinks the water of life in this moment, which he shouldn't be able to live through because he is a man. And he falls into a deep coma. Shani is like way over this at this point.
Oh, one, yeah, because she does.
She's like, "Okay, you keep having these nightmares of being a genocide and famine causing messiah. So just like, don't." And he's like, "I'm not gonna shut up."
But then he keeps
doing stuff that is antithetical to that statement, which the first one being drinking the water of life and then almost killing himself. And she's like, "Why would you be so selfish? We are in love. We are going to be together forever. You said you would love me forever. Forever is a lot shorter if you die, Paul." So like, you doing that was just being selfish, and how dare you? And Lady Jessica, how dare you tell him and to do this, like, in the first place? So you see Shani becoming more and more jaded with the process and also the lies, because Paul is sort of lying to her. Because there are moments in time where he is truthful with his mother, which is like, "I know the version of this that is most likely to happen. I think the thing you said about the weak and fearful Fremen is accurate. But also, I can't go south. I can't. I don't want to." And she's like, "Come on." And he's like, "I don't know. Maybe." Right. At one point in the movie, it can be summed up as him going, "Fine,
Right, right. And then it time jumps.
Right.
But do you, so is this a product of Paul being consumed by the power? Like the, he didn't believe, like, I'm no Messiah, but like, now that things are coming true and it's happening, right, he's like leaning into like, you know what? Yeah, let's do it.
No, I don't think he's coming. I don't think he's come to the conclusion that he deserves this. I don't think he's come to the conclusion that he is meant to be. Although I would say like the religious analogy is pretty strong as Shani awakens him by mixing her tears with the water across his lips, at which point he attains both like knowledge of the past and visions of the future, and begins to also be able to talk with his the version of his adult yet to be born sister, and simultaneously realizes that the Baron is his maternal grandfather. Like, all of those things happen at the same time while he is saying it. It's the cool part about this movie is, and this story as a whole, is that it's incredibly complicated. And for Paul specifically, who sees all of the options, knows the consequences, negative and positive, and is trying his best to like live up to his father and placate his mother and live up to the expectations of Shani, who he does love, but also, you know, what is the difference between like duty and, or not duty, but like the knowing what the future can be.
Yeah.
And choosing what it will be.
And yes, he does love Chani, and he says, I will love you till my last breath. And, you know, when they're getting into a fight, and he gets stabbed in the tummy. Like, he breathing real hard, and it cuts to Chani. But when he said to the Emperor, I will wed your daughter willingly, you see that shade that Shani threw over that
way? Yeah, that was a really good like two shot between Florence Pugh and Zendaya, where Florence Pugh looks at her and she's like, oh, that's going to be a problem.
I don't like this position I'm in.
And by the way, like, even before that fight comes the scene where Stilgar's like, all right, well, you got to kill me, though. Even if you want to talk, you have to kill me. At which point, Paul Atreides is like, no, we're done with that now. We're done with your weird rules. I'm in charge now. And then the Fremen are like, oh, I guess we kill Paul, right? At which point he just looks at a guy and tells him his future/past. And then the guy's like, well,
that's right. I mean,
you're spot on. So,
and then Stilgar's just like, as written.
Yeah, right. As written, we don't have to do the stuff. What you said goes. right on.
Yeah, so something that happened towards the end too, when Paul and Fade Rautha are fighting it out, they very specifically made the choice to not have music, and I love it when movies do that.
Yeah,
it sets that really tense tone of everyone in the room watching this. And no music, just the sounds of fighting. And several other movies have done this in the past, and it is as effective every time for me. And I loved that little detail.
It speaks to the silence that we talked about earlier.
Sure. Yeah.
How bold of a choice that is to put that, especially in scenes that are like high octane.
Oh, yeah.
And this is all the while where Paul Atreides' plan has worked, right? He has baited the Emperor and his entire army to Arrakis. And Paul, through that one-on-one combat with Fade Rautha, wins the Emperorship. And it was, I think, interesting, the fight, because they set up Fade Rautha to be a very good fighter.
Yeah.
But also he did sort of, it wasn't close, but it was a little close with the Atreides who wasn't poisoned. So going into that fight, I was like, okay, but how good is he really?
Yeah.
And turns out pretty good.
He's pretty good. He pretty much, you know, within the grasp of the last thrust of his blade, won the battle. You know, he stabbed Paul. Paul was very injured, and just that slip of the blade, the last stab, did him in.
Yeah, this is all the while Paul is threatening to destroy Arrakis's spice fields with the Atreides' atomic bombs if anyone intervenes, including the other royal houses.
Right.
Which, I don't know, there's a tinge of, the bombs to that.
Too many.
And also, you know, is Paul bluffing? I don't think he is.
Although, I don't think so either.
Because there's a truthsayer there. Let's all remember, like, the Bene Gesserits are truthsayers.
Right.
So either he's blocking out because he's so strong with the voice, as he does the voice, by the way. Lady Jessica's mom is like, oh, what the heck?
Yeah, whenever they do that, the cut to them using the voice, that's where that bass came in and smacks you in the chest.
Yeah,
that's really good.
That hard cut between Lady Jessica and the truthsayer for the Emperor, where Lady Jessica was like, told you. And the other lady was like, you suck. You shouldn't have.
Yeah.
Anyway, Paul spares the Emperor's life, offers himself to the Emperor's daughter directly after saying to Zendaya, like, by the way, like, I love you forever. And she's like, I wonder why he's saying that. And then she finds out real quick.
Just like don't pay attention to this next line.
Yeah. Well, yeah, turn off your ears real quick.
Yeah.
Get out of here. He makes Christopher Walken kiss Paul's signet ring. And the great houses then refuse to accept Paul's ascendancy. So Paul orders his Fremen to start attacking the orbiting fleet in retaliation, kicking off the jihad, the war that is or that was promised slash was understood by Paul the entire time to be perhaps inevitable. And Stilgar leads the Fremen onto the confiscated Sardaukar ships. They're dead now, so they don't need them.
Yeah.
And Jessica and Aaliyah, the unborn Anya Taylor-Joy, reflect upon the fact that this is the beginning of Muad'Dib Hadib's holy war, while a heartbroken Shani, refusing to bow to Paul, departs on a sandworm. We skipped over the part where Paul learned how to ride a grandfather sandworm.
Yeah, so that's insane, but it was as written. Going back to the sandworm really, really quick, because I think it goes without saying that it was sick, right? But the one scene where they're like, Lady Jessica, we're going to go to the south and talk to the, what are they called? The free, oh my God, the other Fremen. What the hell do they call? They have a name. Oh my God, I just blanked out, man.
The other one?
Yeah. The Separatists, or what are they called?
Fundamentalists,
thank you. So they're going to talk to fundamentalists. We got there. And they have like a Conestoga wagon of people on the back of the sand dune.
Sure.
And Lady Jessica's in her little pod like Baby Yoda. And I'm like,
yeah,
this is insane.
Right. The fact that they can just ride them around. Like, it was hard enough to get one person on there, but they were like, all right.
Now they're like, yeah, how do they get an entire fleet of people on there?
Let's Oregon Trail this. And we're going to be going over a lot of some bison are going
to
die.
Yeah, thank God they don't have to ford any rivers, you know.
They're going to ford a river. Well, they would if they're fording sand rivers, I suppose.
Rivers of quicksand.
Right. Yeah. So that's the end of the movie. And again, we won't be getting a Dune 3 entitled Messiah for quite some time. Probably not for 4 to 5 years. This is probably going to be like 2028 because there's going to be 2 to 3 years in between filming. And then this movie took 2 years from the time it was done filming to when it went into theaters. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
And when did the first Dune come out? Were they filming simultaneously when that first Dune came out?
No, I think it filmed pre-COVID and it came out mid-COVID.
Yeah, because I remember we watched it when it was streaming only. It came out on streaming.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It shot 3 or 4 years ago.
That's crazy. I didn't realize it was before, like when you said it was before Austin Butler was Elvis, that just, I can't fathom that timeline in
right,
my head.
Like we're watching Masters of the Air right now.
Yeah.
Austin Butler shot Dune 2 and then Elvis and then Masters of the Air. And we're watching Masters of the Air and Dune at the same time.
Yeah. We watched Masters of the Air first. That's crazy. Speaking of Masters of the Air, we are doing a recap of Masters of the Air on our Friday. We release on Fridays typically. We're going to be doing 6 and 7 this Friday. So stay tuned for that. Listen for that. It's a good time. The show is great. I really love it.
Yeah, me too. Before we go, though, I wanted to discuss one more thing.
Sure.
And that is Timothy. So
Timothy.
Timothy Chalamet.
Timmy.
And Zendaya. And we've already really kind of discussed everyone else. Rebecca Ferguson, the forefront of all of it. But let's discuss those two. What did you think of their portrayals? They are sort of like as zeitgeisty as it gets at the moment. I think there's some fatigue with both of them. You know, this Willy Wonka guy and Zendaya, like two of the most famous people on earth leading this movie. I mean, Dave Bautista is like fourth or fifth on the call sheet.
Yeah.
And Florence Pugh is like sixth on the call sheet. So what do you think of their chemistry? What do you think of their portrayals of these characters?
So I think Timothy Chalamet is a good cast. I mean, when you compare it to the original movie, they look very similar. Like it looks physically like a good cast. I think he is very good as Paul Atreides, especially when he gets on his monologues in front of the whole group of the Fremen. He's powerful. He's got a very powerful presence. Even though he's a very tiny, small, skinny little guy. But he's got an excellent presence. I think it portrays very well. Zendaya, I think, I could take or leave her playing in this role. I like Zendaya. She's great in Euphoria.
Yeah.
I think I'm starting to get a little bit of fatigue. Maybe not with Timothy Chalamet as much just because I haven't seen him in as much, but I've seen Zendaya in a number of things. And before Dune, there was a trailer for her new movie, which I can't even remember the name. It looked so bad. And yeah. I'm just like, I don't care.
Sure. You know? Yeah. I think the Timothée Chalamet thing is like, it shouldn't work.
Yeah.
Like,
but it does.
Sort of, yeah. It has no business working, but it somehow does.
That's good. I like him as Paul. I mean, I like Zendaya as Chani too, but like, I think that they could have gone with a few different people in both these roles, but I think, you know, generally it's a good cast.
Yeah. And acting in kind, this podcast shouldn't work and it also doesn't. So if you want to help that out, you can join the Patreon at patreon.com/HBOBYZ. It's $1 a month. You get to join a private Discord. You get these thingies earlier, ad-free. Do I sound disingenuous? Adam also says your name at the end of the show, which he's going to do like right now.
Well, you know, I'm going to make up for this disingenuousness that Ryan is portraying on our podcast. Yeah. We are great, Ryan.
Oh.
We're great. Just speak truths.
Oh.
We have the best podcasting on the internet, and no one can tell me otherwise. But thank you so much for Sunshine, Connor O'Dowd, Jamie Lochner, Adam Donging Ryan, Chris Wood, Brent Ginn, Craig, John Jewers, Major Woody, Butter Nichols, Susan, and Buffalo Pizzle. Thank you so much for your patronage. Thank you for your subscriptions. And thank you, Sunshine and Brent Ginn, for being our $5 a month tier patrons. We appreciate everything and that you give and anyone else gives. And please subscribe, share, like, comment on our socials. Been very active on Threads lately at the HBO Boys Pod. So that's fun. It's weird because I'll comment on stuff, get likes and responses, but when I post on our own Threads, nothing.
Sure.
Nothing.
Yeah, sure.
So, well, do that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so to finish us off, do the low throat singing thing. Okay, no. You went into dubstep there at the end, which is what happened.
I did. It's a guilty pleasure.
One more time. Okay, bye.